They stand across the West in ruins, ghostly apparitions of one of the darkest moments in American history. Concentration camps, 10 in total, built during World War II to incarcerate 120,000 Japanese Americans for the crime of not being white. Today, only two are designated as National Historic Sites, Manzanar in California and Minidoka in Idaho. Now, a bill in Congress seeks to designate a third concentration camp as a historic site, the Granada War Relocation Center in Colorado, better known as Camp Amachi. At a time when hate crimes against Asian Americans continue to rise, activists say it couldn't come at a more important time. I'm Gustavo Ariano. You're listening to The Times, daily news from the LA Times. Today is May 27th, 2021. Another mass shooting, this time 9 dead in San Jose. President Biden asked for further investigations into the origins of COVID-19. And Amazon buys MGM, signaling a new era in Hollywood. Coming this summer, James Bond rings up your kombucha at Whole Foods. Today, we'll talk with Caitlin Kim, a reporter who's covering the push to turn Camp Amachi into a National Historic Site. And we'll speak with Bruce Embry, who has been part of an annual pilgrimage to Manzanar for over 50 years. Who says bipartisanship doesn't still exist in Washington? On April 14th, Colorado Congressman Ken Buck, he's a Republican, and Democrat Joe Neguse introduced a bill that would designate Camp Amachi as a National Historic Site. If passed, it would represent the culmination of decades of work from Japanese-American activists to save this part of an American history, even though it represents a nadir for the community. Joining me to talk about the fight for Camp Amachi's future is Caitlin Kim. She's a reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Thank you for being here, Caitlin.
Thank you for having me.
Over 7,000 Japanese Americans were incarcerated at Camp Amachi at the height of World War II. Describe where it was in Colorado and what was there.
So Amachi is actually a mile outside of the town Granada. It's in the southeast corner of the state. It's grassland. So you go there, it is dry, it's desolate in the summer, really hot. In the winters, it's really cold. And all you see to the horizon is sort of grass. That was what was there. And then in the matter of a few months, this relocation center, an internment camp for Japanese Americans, was built, and it became the 10th largest city in Colorado as soon as it was opened. But, you know, you go there now and you can see there's not much there. You see the bones of what was left. And that's part of the reason why Congressman Neguse and Congressman Buck and supporters of Camp Amachi want to make sure that this site is remembered so that people can go there and learn about this dark time in American history.
When you went there to Camp Amachi, what were your impressions of the place?
I went there in the fall, October of last year. It was hauntingly beautiful because it's such a desolate place. I can't describe it. It was a beautiful day. The sky was blue. And then all you see is this dry brown grass going everywhere and sort of barbed wire encasing this large area of land. I was driving down the grid of dirt road and just sort of looking at the foundations that have been, you know, overgrown with weeds. There was like a tumbleweed the size up, like up to my knee, that was just rolling along with me. When you think about like the fact that over 7,000 people were detained there for no reason, it's sort of heartbreaking to see. If you go there now, as I mentioned, you just see these bones, like dirt roads that sort of are the skeleton of a grid pattern for where all these barracks would be. You see the foundations of the former buildings. What happened was a history professor at the time, John Hooper, had heard about this in his studies, and he wanted to go see it and saw that there was nothing there. And, you know, being a history teacher, he got some of his students. He wanted to give them a challenging project, and he asked them to sort of research the history of Amachi. And from there, the Amachi Historical Preservation Society grew, and they have taken pains to sort of record histories there, to maintain the cemetery, to rebuild certain buildings, like a barracks, to show what the place was like in 1942 to 1945. So this was a lot of like local work that went into it. And they could only go so far. Now they kind of want to sort of hand off the project or at least make sure that it gets more support. This is what Buck, Nagus, and others want to make sure Camp Amachi gets more support from the National Park Service to make sure the history is really preserved and that people can come and learn from this time.
Yeah, you covered the recent Colorado State hearing over Camp Amachi's possible historic designation. What was the overall tone of that meeting?
The congressional hearing was pretty bipartisan. I think a lot of people were interested in hearing about this history. There was a survivor from the camp who testified. His name was Bob Fujigami. He was 90 years old.
And you are now recognized for your oral remarks.
Good morning. My name is Robert Bob Fujigami. I live in Evergreen, Colorado. I'm an Amachi survivor. I'm also a Navy veteran.
And when he arrived at Camp Amachi in 1942, he was 11.
Amachi is a traumatic subject for me and has been for most of my life.
And this is what he told the bipartisan group of Congress members who were there at the subcommittee hearing. You know, he told them like what it was like to sort of leave his home in California.
In May 1942, when my family was ordered by the Army to leave our home and 20-acre combination fruit and vegetable farm. The time frame given us was less than 1 week.
Being told that they had a week to pack up their stuff, he had to leave his bunnies, his dog behind. They could only take what they could carry in a suitcase.
No destination given, no reason given, except two vague words. Military necessity.
And then, like, they wound up in Camp Amachi.
In Amachi, we were assigned to a flimsy military barrack that would be our home for the next 3 years. Each barrack had been cut into six rooms. Our family of 10 was given two rooms, each 20 by 20.
That's a lot of people in a small amount of space. And he sort of told about the hardship of it and how, you know, they were kept there. You know, there were no trials. There were no accusations made against them. He had no idea what was going on. You know, he was 11 years old. But it just how traumatic that experience was. And that's what he told the committee members.
While we were in Amachi, we lost everything. We lost our home, our farm, our equipment, everything. Over time, our sense of family, of purpose, and future was destroyed. In Amachi, my mother had a stroke. My father broke his back. Neither fully recovered. No charges were leveled against us. No trial, no hearings. We were a loyal, patriotic, law-abiding citizens who had never done anything wrong. Why were we treated this way? Why were we singled out for eviction and incarceration?
How was his testimony received?
It was received well. I mean, people were moved to hear about this part of U.S. history. World War II, you learn about, you know, the U.S. military in Europe and fighting in the Pacific. You don't always hear about what went on to Japanese Americans in the U.S. And I mean, that's part of the reason I wanted to go to Amachi. I mean, I read about this when I was a kid, but when I actually learned there was a site in Colorado, it kind of surprised me. So that's part of the reason on my own one weekend I decided to go there and visit it.
It's such an interesting contrast to, say, the debates during the 1980s over reparations for Japanese Americans who were in the concentration camps. Back then, the politicians there were just like, no, we do not want to revisit this moment in American history. It wasn't even wrong. There was all these suspicions. Now, at least, even during these incredibly divided times, at least people understand this was a bad moment in our nation's history, one of the worst moments in our nation's history. But it's important to remember it so we never repeat that same mistake again.
Yeah, and to echo something you had said in sort of the intro, and this is something that Bob Fujigami had mentioned as well as in his testimony, was that this is still happening now. You know, he wanted to shine this light on this forgotten part of history to tell a more complete story of America, but he also mentioned that this is actually something that's still going on now. You know, the spike in Asian American hate crimes, it is just sort of a continuation of that Amachi story. And that is also part of the reason why he's hopeful that Congress will, in fact, designate it a historic site to help shine a light on the fact that Asian Americans are still discriminated against so people can learn about it and do something about it.
Why did it even take this long for Congress to even consider a bill to make Camp Amachi a national historic site?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know that I have an answer to that. I think part of it is just sometimes things take so slow to happen here in Congress. But I also think part of it was people have been taking slow steps in Colorado to do this. There was a bill passed, I think, about 2 years ago that would do a study about whether or not Amachi should be a part of the National Park Service. That study got delayed because of COVID, and I think this bill, if it passes, it might actually leapfrog ahead of the study. I think part of it is the times, right? Because of this rise again in Asian American hate crimes, I think this is a way that people could sort of highlight it and say we're doing something about it by spotlighting sort of this past historical time. That's just my guess. I think there are a lot of things in Congress that take a long time to pass. But there is a lot of bipartisan support, especially from Colorado, for this. So there is momentum building for this. But I think people are hopeful that it'll happen, if not this Congress, the next.
What would this federal historic designation then mean for people like Mr. Fujigami?
I think for them, it'd be very personal, right? Like Mr. Fujigami had said that he wanted to do this so that history couldn't be ignored, forgotten, or remain invisible. And when you are a national historic site, it's hard to be any of those three. They put resources into it, right? They would build like a welcome center. They would have maps. They would have a ranger there, right? Someone who's there to answer questions. The Amachi Historical Preservation Society is a volunteer organization. So they do a tour. One volunteer does a tour on the weekends. I missed that tour when I got there. But when I called, they were like, we have this app, you can sort of listen to it. It's a little podcast as you drive around.
To begin the audio tour, keep driving south on the entrance road. You're on G Street. On the left, you will pass the former location of the camp motor pool and garage where government cars were serviced.
But this is all volunteer stuff, right? Like, they've done a great job, but getting, I think, some federal dollars into it really helped put it on the map.
Thank you so much for this interview, Caitlin.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more after this break. Perhaps the most known Japanese-American concentration camp in the United States is the Manzanar National Historic Site. It's about 100 miles west of Death Valley in California. In 1969, about 150 survivors and activists organized a pilgrimage there. It was an important moment in Japanese-American history. Before that, most concentration camp survivors wanted nothing to do with them. After the first Manzanar visit, activists began to stress the importance of these camps to teach about what America should never do again. Bruce Embry is the co-chair of the Manzanar Committee, which continues to organize a pilgrimage to Manzanar every year since. His mother, Sue Kunitomi Embry, was incarcerated in Manzanar. So, Bruce, describe Manzanar, at least the way your mother would describe it to you when she was there, that sense of isolation, being, you know, her and her family ripped apart from their homes and being put in a place far, far away from them with, you know, weather that probably they had never experienced before.
Well, Manzanar today is really, really different from 1969 when my mother first returned, that time voluntarily. Now, these areas were selected. They were on Native American land. And the process itself, the trip itself, was traumatic, regardless of where they were going. And my mother described how they sat in silence.
Just for the record, to have it on tape, would you give me your name and where you live?
My name is Sue Kunitomi Embry, and I live in Los Angeles.
Tell me about getting to the train depot and the trip to Manzanar.
They had us pull all the shades down so we couldn't see outside and people couldn't see inside. And the train took off. I went through the San Fernando Valley, through Palmdale, Lancaster, all the way up to Lone Pine Station, and took all day to get there.
Remember, this is 1942. So to go from Los Angeles to the high desert, Lone Pine area, took some time. It took all day, in fact. And she said none of us were talking. She said some people were crying, which is very unusual for that Japanese American to be crying publicly at that time. And she said we had no idea where we were, and we had never heard of Lone Pine. And she said she actually blanked out much of that day. She did remember a few things.
What are your first memories of seeing Manzanar?
Well, it was dark when we got to Lone Pine Station. They told us to get off and wait for the buses to take us to Manzanar. We didn't know where, how far it was. It was very dark by the time we got on the buses. And they told us that the suitcases would not be unloaded until the next day, so we didn't have anything to change into when we got to Manzanar.
When she got there, it was extremely cold. It was dark, pitch dark, and they got to their barrack, and there was a single light bulb and 8 cots. Many families arrived to find basically canvas bags and hay and these steel cots, army cots, sitting there. They had to stuff their own mattresses and try and make do. And so it was very traumatic.
When my mother got into the room, she sat down on one of the mattresses and she says, "My, what a place." And she never talked about that for many, many years afterward.
There's been pilgrimages going back there ever since 1969, the past 2 years, of course, virtually. What are these pilgrimages like that the Manzanar Committee holds?
Well, since my mother and the others began to organize them, always had kind of a twofold purpose. One was to simply talk story and describe and educate people about what it was like and what actually took place. Because remember, there was a real concerted effort to silence, not just within the Japanese American community. People are talking about this model minority myth. There was a concerted effort as well from our government and affiliated academics like the people who developed this so-called model minority myth to basically not talk about what happened or to put it in the most euphemistic terms, try and create this image that it really was only for the protection of the Japanese Americans, that, you know, it was just an unfortunate little mistake, as opposed to really understanding that it was a wholesale incarceration of a community of color and depriving them of their civil and human rights. And I think that was, you know, really important for my mother, was to make sure people knew what happened, not just the forensic facts, the numbers and the statistics, but actually talk about what the human toll was, how it actually shaped socially, politically, and economically the Japanese American community. And the other aspect was to try and look at how Manzanar and the forced removal of the Japanese American community was part and parcel of the history of the United States, that this wasn't an aberration. It wasn't just a unique one-off, that the history of the United States has been bound up with colonial and racial injustice, that our fundamental nature of many of our laws and institutions are rooted in a racist and oppressive framework and experience. So that was one of the things my mother was very cognizant about. In 1973, in that pilgrimage, which was really the first full-scale pilgrimage, she talked about how Manzanar was not just important as a social justice site for the Japanese American community or the broader Asian American community, but it was a site of conscience for all Americans.
To all ghosts of the Issei.
You who risked and lost everything, this land and every parcel of this country will never again be used to divide us.
Our history will only be a precedent for peace.
You mentioned your mother, Sukuni Tomi Embry, and she helped organize that first Manzanar pilgrimage back in 69. So for people like your mother who were incarcerated there, how are they feeling when they returned after so many years?
When my mother returned from the first pilgrimage in 1969, the reaction of the community was definitely mixed. There was quite a bit of pushback, and some of it not so pleasant. There was a lot of vitriolic comments about why are you dredging up the past? Why are you criticizing our government now? We've gotten over it. We've moved on. And how dare you put our lives and our community at risk? And I think a lot of it was based on fear, frankly, and just the trauma of having been marched off to an unfamiliar place, incarcerated behind barbed wire, by your own government. So I think the trauma was still ever-present. And I remember one incident in particular. We were in Little Tokyo on First Street. My mother was a practicing Buddhist, as was my grandmother, at the Koyasan Buddhist Temple. And she encountered an older gentleman who spoke to her in Japanese. And he was not at all shy about expressing his displeasure with her being on the news. He basically chastised her. He was just very upset that she would bring up Manzanar.
If Camp Amachi gets National Historic Site designation, it's just going to be the third former Japanese-American concentration camp to get that distinction. Why do you think this hasn't happened more? I mean, there's 10, and this would only be the third one.
It's been a long, hard fight. And even though I think our country is at the very early stages of a racial reckoning, this is not a surprise to me. I mean, what's clear in the midst of this incredible wave of lethal anti-Asian violence is how woefully ignorant our country is about the history of Asian Americans in this country. So it's no accident that we're not able to easily recognize or popularize what happened to us. It's met a lot of resistance. It takes a lot of work. You remember, Manzanar was closed in 1945. My mother and others returned in 1969. It wasn't dedicated as a National Historic Site until 2004. So it took decades, literally decades, to get Manzanar built. And my mother had to work and craft congressional legislation to get the Congress to actually appropriate monies to build Manzanar. It takes a tremendous amount of work. And I think Amachi would be a huge step forward to beginning to explain to our country what happened, because so many people have no idea or literally say, oh, it couldn't have possibly happened here.
Yeah, with that designation then, Bruce, how does, you know, designating as National Historic Sites, Amachi and all these other concentration camps, how does that combat hate?
Well, there's a number of sites that are developing what we call interpretive centers. So you can go to Tule Lake, for example, or Bainbridge Island, right off of Seattle and Washington State. And you can go to these places. You can go to Bainbridge, you can go to Manzanar, and you can actually see and listen to oral histories of people who were incarcerated there or forcibly removed from those sites. And they begin to explain what happened to them in particular. And I think what's important is there's a couple things. One is it shows very graphically the intense hatred and racism that was exhibited towards Japanese Americans.
There were more Japanese in Los Angeles than in any other area. In nearby San Pedro, houses and hotels occupied almost exclusively by Japanese were within a stone's throw of a naval air base, shipyards, oil wells. Japanese fishermen had every opportunity to watch the movement of our ships. Japanese farmers were living close to vital aircraft plants. So, as a first step, all Japanese were required to move from critical areas such as these. But of course, this limited evacuation was a solution to only part of the problem. The larger problem, the uncertainty of what would happen among these people in case of a Japanese invasion, still remained.
So you see these images and listen to people speaking about the actual impact that it had on their lives. And I think what it does is it gives people a sense of the actual human toll that racist acts take and extract on people. People will walk away from these sites visibly moved and visibly impacted by the stories that are told. And I think that's what's important about this. These are not dead archaeological sites. These are civil rights sites. These are actual sites of conscience where you can talk about what happened not that long ago. And I think that's what's important. It's the story. It's the message that we want to convey that is so important, because this country has erased or downplayed, or for lack of a better word, whitewashed the actual history. And I think that's some of the reckoning that we have to do now. I think that, you know, our country has been intentionally ignorant, intentionally silent about the way communities of color have been treated. And I think that it's very important we tell these stories. I think that the same applies to the question of reparations for the Black community. We have to go back and understand what the actual history looked like.
Thank you so much for this interview, Bruce.
De nada.
That's it for this episode of The Times, daily news from the LA Times. On tomorrow's show, I take my customary Friday day off as two of my colleagues, Talk Lowriders, take a little trip with them. Our show is produced by Shannon Lin, Stephen A. Cuevas, and Denise Guerra. Our executive producer is Abby Fenter-Swanson. Our engineer is Mario Diaz. Our editor is Julia Turner. And our theme music is by Andrew Epin. I'm Gustavo Ariano. We'll be back tomorrow with all the news and desmadre. Gracias.